Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. And before I get started really today, I want to let you know that there's an announcement that I need to make about the feed URL for this podcast. So if you'll stick around at the end of the podcast, I'll tell you about that. I'll also put something in the show notes and I'll post about it on Twitter, but it's not an emergency, just something that I want to let everybody know. That being said, my guest for this episode is Brian Kozer of the 10 to 1 podcast, and we're going to be discussing Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which won the 2005 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Brian, thanks for doing this.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. You were one of the people who reached out to me on the contact form, which I always appreciate. And you came over from the Sci-Fi Christian, I believe.
That's right. Yep. Heard your episode with Matt, and I think probably heard your Take Me to Your Reader episodes over there first.
Nice. Well, why don't you tell my listeners a little about yourself?
Sure. Let's see. My wife and I podcast as well. We do 10 to 1, where we do top 10 lists about everything. The canonical examples I usually give are we did great songs where we listened to Rolling Stones' top 100 greatest songs and picked our 10 favorites from there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Neither of us really knew anything about music or popular music, I guess. And so that was a lot of fun. But then we also do like fast food restaurants or frozen pizzas. So like really lowbrow and then I guess medium brow.
So nice. We want to cover all the brows, right?
Exactly. So yeah, and then of course sci-fi fantasy stuff and books and movies and things as well. So everything's thrown in there, whatever we're interested in.
Nice. I've got a queue of your episodes ready to listen to. So I saw that you recently crossed 100 episodes. That's cool.
Yeah, that was exciting for sure.
Well, what about some of your nerdy history, you know, history of as a science fiction fan?
Yeah. So let's see. Neither of my parents would consider themselves to be nerds, but my mom really likes to read, really encouraged us to read growing up. And so I was the kid checking out 20 books at a time at the library and discovered C.S. Lewis and Brian Jakes and later Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett and Tolkien. And so really got into it on the reading side. And then my dad he's career military and athletic and everything, but did have the entire series of Star Trek, the original series on VHS. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, so that was pretty influential for me growing up watching that with him. And yeah, I mean, it's continued on from there. Still enjoy reading. My wife also enjoys science fiction fantasy. So I've enjoyed showing her some TV that she missed and reading together with her.
Nice. You're lucky to have a simpatico science fiction wife.
Yeah.
Nice. My wife has never really been into science fiction, so it's got to be a very specific kind of, you know, movie or thing that I can slip by her defense.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, did you get a chance to tally up how many Hugo Award winners you'd read?
Oh, yeah, I did. And I guess I also forgot to mention that my mom, another nice thing that she did was make me keep a list of every book that I've read.
Oh,
so
nice.
I've got a list of every book that I've read all the way back to age 8. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, especially for someone that me likes to make lists and kind of a completist.
What's that tally, by the way?
Oh, let's see. I'm a little over 1,000.
Awesome.
Yeah, I did an episode last year when I hit 1,000. So that was pretty exciting. So I made it a goal and I really had to push for it, but from 8 to 28. So 20 years and I read 1,000 books. So
that's awesome.
That's pretty cool. But yeah, so I was able to go back and I've read 14 Hugo winners.
Cool. Yeah, I just I crossed 31.
Nice.
I realized I hadn't been counting The Sword and the Stone, which I did an episode with Matt and Ben about.
Oh, okay.
And so I've started counting that one. I haven't decided if I want to put that in my feed or not. I think I'll wait until a month when I'm super lazy and don't want to record.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Well, let's start getting into our kind of non-spoiler discussion of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Yeah.
Why this book?
Right. So I grew up reading a lot, got to college, pretty much stopped reading for pleasure. Mm-hmm. And then right after college, had almost a full year between graduating from college and getting married. So ton of free time and really got back into reading. And I remember discovering this book during that summer and being surprised that I'd not heard of it before with the awards that it won, and really seeming like it was up my alley. So the time period, so it's that Regency England, Napoleonic Wars. I've always been a fan of that time period. Even just the book itself, I have it in hardback, and it's this big black tome. It's got this minimalistic cover with this really beautiful typography. It's got the rough cut paper edges. And so just everything from the presentation sold me. And then you know, I was hooked from the first chapter. So, so that one really made a big splash with me. And it's been one of my favorites. I did have some problems with it the first time I read through it. And maybe we can talk about that in a little bit on some of my reread thoughts. But it's one of my favorites for sure now.
Cool. Well, if you had to give a quick non-spoiler synopsis of this massive book.
Right. Yeah. So my one sentence pitch is Jane Austen and Charles Dickens wrote a fairy story together.
Right.
In an alternate universe. And this is it. Sort of a plot overview would be you find out very quickly that magic used to exist in England, and then it disappeared suddenly. A few hundred years ago, nobody knows why. And today, magicians are just academics. They don't actually do magic. They just talk about magic and write about magic. And so then the main plot of the story is the Norland Strange of the title trying to bring magic back to England. And it's about their relationship and the different adventures that they go through together and separately. And is there anything else you want to add to the plot?
No, I think that's pretty good.
Okay.
I had written down that it's, you know, Austen style book with magic in 19th century England.
Right. And I think it's interesting that Clark didn't just write a book set in the 1800s, but it's actually, it's in the style of an 1800s novel. So just matches the style with, so the omniscient narrator. And the language and even the spelling and things like that.
Right. I was telling my wife about it last night. I can't remember. I used some word and she's like, "Where'd that word come from?" And I went, "Oh, book I've been reading."
Nice.
And I said, "Just so you know, if I say the word show, it's with an E. And if I say something like stopped, it's S-T-O-P-T.
Right. Or choose with a U.
Right. All right. So just kind of by overall thoughts, this is a first time read for me. It sounds to me like, you know, this was a favorite of yours. And so it's on a reread and I'll be curious to know how that went.
Right.
It's definitely fantasy, which is not necessarily my favorite thing. I prefer the science fiction side. And it's also just very literary, of course, because it's done in that kind of Austen style or Dickens style. I've heard it compared to Gothic novels as well. But I'm not well enough read in English lit.
Right.
To really be able to make those comparisons. And I do feel like I probably missed something by the fact that I'm not that familiar with the English canon to get all the references that are probably there.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that it's more or less alternate history. Because I do like the fact that it's just very straightforward in this is the England that we're in and here's all this history, which it to me, I had to go look like, wait, is the Raven King myth, is that actually a thing?
Yeah. She did a really good job of grafting in these kind of fantastic elements. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Because it just read like straightforward history in a lot of ways. I think I would say after a first read on this one, I'd say I admire the book, but I don't love it. Just because it was an undertaking.
Right. And
I don't know. I've said this on previous podcasts. I'm starting to doubt my ability to get through large books because this one took me a long time.
Sure.
And full disclosure here, I was having a difficult enough time that at some point I had gotten the audiobook from my library. And as I was reading in print, I actually started listening to the audiobook and I caught up with myself. And I had a day where I can't remember if I was putting up Christmas decorations. I was doing something where I had like 3 or 4 hours all to myself. But my hands were busy and my eyes were busy, but my ears were not. And so I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to move on ahead with the audiobook. And so like the middle third to half, I took in on audio, and then my my loan on the audiobook expired before I finished. Okay. So I went back to print at the end. So it's like
interesting
50-50 audio and print on this one.
Huh.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So what about for you on the reread?
Right. I think once we get into spoilers, I can talk about some of the specific issues that I had in the first time read. But definitely on reread, it didn't feel like she wasted any pages. The first time read, the first third kind of dragged for me, and this last third also I thought was too long. First time I read through, I really liked that middle section and thought that we really just needed to get to there, and maybe that should have been closer to the end. I've changed my mind on that now.
Yeah,
but I can definitely, I was curious if you have felt that it, maybe this is more of a spoiler talk, but certain characters getting introduced at certain times.
Right. Yeah, no, I think I kind of, I never found myself bored with the book. I just found myself not getting through it very fast.
Okay.
You know, the prose is very rich. Mm-hmm. The characters are well drawn. I was really enjoying the first couple hundred pages of it. And, you know, just like I said, I just had a little hard time getting through it. Mm-hmm. And then I really enjoyed the end parts that I read as well. And
okay.
I think the fact that I took the middle part in on audio, I can't really tell you how, what my experiences of it were, because I wasn't reading that in print. I had somebody else doing the work for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed the first third and the last third.
Okay.
It's just the middle section that I'm not sure.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, I found it compelling enough that I didn't put the audiobook away, and the performance was good. So.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because this one seems kind of interesting. So there's a lot of footnotes, which I'd like to talk about, but how do they handle that?
Yeah, so the footnotes are basically done just almost in line, where it'll say, you know, footnote one, and then it'll go through that whole explanation and then come back to narrative just seamlessly. And it worked really well. Yeah, that's definitely something I think to let people know about, though, right? Because it's in... How long is the book in hardcover?
Oh, let me check real quick. It's 750, 770,
okay.
Close to 800 pages.
So I read it on my tablet, and it was like 880, I think, but the last 60 pages of it were footnotes.
Wow. Yeah, they're in line in hardback or soft cover. And yeah, there's times where it's two entire pages are footnotes. There's some really long ones. And then, of course, like you're saying, there's a bunch of them.
So on a reread, do you still mine through all those footnotes, or do you just move on?
Yeah, so the footnotes are some of my favorite parts, actually. So that's how she does world building, I guess, is how she decided to, instead of having, you know, two characters have a conversation where they tell each other things that they should already know.
As you know, Jim.
Exactly. instead of that, I don't know if this is part of the style of the time. I also haven't read a bunch of, I've read some Jane Austen and some Charles Dickens, and that's about it. So I don't know if the heavy use of footnotes is a thing, but she uses that to tell us mostly about magical history. She tells us about some things that are happening in line with the story that are kind of side trips. In fact, I found out that my favorite part of the book, my favorite moment, is in a footnote, and I didn't remember that until I was rereading it. So I'll bring that up in the spoiler discussion. But I thought that was really interesting that she would put to me a really powerful moment in a footnote like that. So I definitely still read through those on the reread.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I was curious, you know, if I ever get back to this one, if I'd want to skip those or go back through them
again
as the experience. I mean, it's easy in an ebook cause you just click the little number and it takes you back there. And well, so before we get into spoilers, if you were going to recommend this novel, to people, on what basis would you do it?
Yeah. So I've been talking about Jane Austen. That's an easy sell. If you're listening to this, you're probably into sci-fi fantasy. And if you're a Jane Austen or a Charles Dickens fan or fan of that time period, then this is a slam dunk. You mentioned alternate history. So if you're into alternate history or secret history, I think this is one you should check out. And then for me, I've read a lot of fantasy, and a lot of it is just Tolkien clones nowadays.
Right.
So if you're looking for something more unique, this is definitely something that is not done often. I guess the closest that I can think of is like Neil Gaiman, who writes in that sort of not from Tolkien lineage, sort of the magic exists in the everyday world and it's on the edges of our lives. So if you like Neil Gaiman, I guess this is possibly something you could check out.
Yeah, I wrote down, you know, it's if you like large books that have great prose and great characters and lots of time to enjoy them, then this will be right up your alley.
Yeah, that does make it a hard sell. There is a miniseries as well, BBC miniseries on Netflix. I know this isn't Take Me to Your Reader, but if you can't sell someone on if you're listening and you're not into 800 page novels, maybe at least check out the miniseries.
Yeah, I've actually been watching that, and it's excellent. I really like the actor from Mr. Norrell. He embodies him really, really well. I've liked that actor for quite a while.
Okay,
even though I can't come up with his name off the top of my head. It's definitely good. So, okay, I say we get into spoiler talk.
I'm excited to do that.
I think it's interesting that, you know, like you said, magic exists, but is on the edges. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, in this book, like everybody knows that there was a magical history to England.
That's true.
Even though everybody's just kind of, it reminds me a little bit of in Christian theology, the cessationist people who are like, the Holy Spirit stopped doing things after Pentecost, or after the death of the apostles. Mm-hmm. It's like there's people who are like, magic existed, but we don't talk about that anymore, and it's gone. And then there's other people who are like, nope, not so much.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, there's definitely that. And then as well, when they start doing magic again, it's this really huge, mysterious, really powerful. Like, I mean, he's moving cities around. Strange is moving cities around. He's, you know, doing all sorts of crazy things, just completely rewriting geography. Weather magic is apparently really easy to do, which seems like that would be pretty complex, since that's a complex
system. Didn't he move a city over to North America at some point?
Right. Yep. I forgot which city, but. So you're right. It is on the, I guess when I was saying it's on the edges, I was thinking more that it seems like you could stumble into, there's characters that just kind of stumble into fairy.
Right.
And it's, they almost don't even realize that they're there sometimes. And I guess towards the end of the novel, it's much more, once magic has been returned, it's just there for everyone to use apparently.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting too, like I mentioned earlier, she's so good at the world building part that I just took it for granted that a lot of this was based on existing legend.
Yeah. She said that that was one of her goals. She said was that she looked at a country like America and said, we have kind of an American mythology or an American idea of ourselves. And I guess she's talking about like, you know, cowboys and independent and that kind of thing. And she said, Britain doesn't really have an identity like that. So she's kind of, that's one of the things she kind of wanted to, I guess, outside of like King Arthur and those stories, kind of invent a, not like Tolkien did with a kind of an ancient mythology, but sort of a more modern mythology almost. Around England.
Yeah. So you had mentioned you wanted to talk about your favorite moment in the book.
Oh, yeah. So my favorite moment to me, and I read it through the first time, really liked that moment, and then I was hoping they would put it in the miniseries, and they did. And then I go back, and it's just in a footnote, and it's very brief and bare of a description, and it's the book auction where Norrell lets Strange go to Portugal so that he's out of the country and so he can buy up all the books from this estate that's selling off magical books or books of magic, excuse me. And Arabella goes and has to borrow money, which I didn't even really think about it, but it's interesting that she, I guess that's part of the time she was not able to use Jonathan's money because he had, you know, land and a lot of money, but I guess as his wife, she didn't have access to that for some reason. So So she's going around borrowing money and tries to buy a book for her husband. And Norrell just no mercy at all, no feelings, purchases all the books and strides out of the room and leaves her there crying. And that was a pretty powerful moment to me of her really trying to do something for her husband that's really important to him. And Norrell as his partner and as, I'd say even as his friend at that point, just for his own selfish reasons, won't even let him have a single book of his own. So
yeah, it's interesting. I had written down, that the characterization is really great because it's fascinating to me when a book presents a character to you and you think, okay, this is going to be our hero. You know, he's super noble and everything.
Yeah.
And then as you move on, you find out, oh, this guy's really flawed and kind of a jerk. And Norrell is definitely one of those characters, right? Because he starts off as this, I wonder if, you'd see him like on the autism spectrum, right? Because he's almost agoraphobic. He doesn't want to go out. Mm-hmm. When he does his magic for the Learned Society at the beginning, he doesn't even leave his home.
Right.
He does it from there.
Right.
But then, he and Jonathan Strange are antagonistic at some point during the book. And that's fascinating. And I thought it was going to continue that way for the rest of the book. And I was glad to see that there was some reconciliation at the end.
Right. Right. And, I think, Jonathan Strange is also, maybe even a more extreme example of that character. Cause he really seems, especially in contrast to Norrell, that he's going to be the hero and the main character. And, he makes, ends up making magic more important to him than, any of the people around him. And I'm really curious what you thought about him actually by the end of the book. If your thoughts changed on him based on how he treats his wife and just some of the choices that he makes.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a flawed character as well because he starts off as this kind of foppish, flighty,
can't hold down
a gentleman,
job.
But that's it, right?
Right.
Yeah, he can't find a place to land and just takes up magic almost on a whim, right?
Yep.
Which I think is fascinating. And it kind of gets into that, there's a destiny here, because that spell found its way into his hands, of course, and it found his way into his hands through Vinculus and Childermas.
Yep.
And the side characters are really well drawn as well, because Childermas is a fascinating character, and he's somebody I really enjoyed in the miniseries.
Right. Yeah, he's perfect in the miniseries. I think he might actually be my favorite character in the book.
Yeah. And even like down to Drawlight and Lascelles, where Clark, the author, kept almost subverting my expectations of them. Cause I thought, okay, Lascelles is this guy who's very noble, helping out with Mr. Norrell, but you find out he's a real jerk too.
Oh yeah.
At some point. And he straight up murders Drawlight.
Right. Right.
and Drawlight is kind of a pathetic character, right? Kind of a suck up.
Right. Yeah. I definitely, I hated Drawlight a lot less on reread. I remember just really despising him the first time and pitying him a lot more the second time, I guess, knowing how he's going to end up. And then Lascelles, I thought was, I didn't really think about him too much the first time through. But he's really interesting as sort of the dark path that Strange might have taken. So he also starts off as he doesn't have a job. He's rich, but no manners. And then also ends up working with Norrell and even ends up working with the Friends of English Magic, the magical publication, even though he really started off as a super skeptic. And then, of course, I guess you would say his character was worse than Strange. He really, Strange ignores Arabella, and that's not good, obviously. But Lascelles really, really poorly uses women and takes advantage of the time, especially with, having an affair and then leaving the woman. And then it's interesting, the irony of him being trapped for some unknown period of time, defending a woman after that poor use.
Yeah, I thought that was a good wrap up for his character.
Yeah.
We haven't even mentioned Stephen Black
or
the gentleman, right?
Oh, right,
the fairy gentleman,
right?
Who we never got a name for, and I was curious if we were ever going to get that.
Yeah, so there's a fun theory about that that I did not come up with, but that
okay.
That the characters, I guess at least Norrell and Strange, knew the gentleman's name, and that the author has withheld that information so that he cannot be ever summoned again, or yeah, resurrected.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and that makes sense given the way his character ends.
Right.
Steven is definitely an interesting character. And I kept thinking, well, you know, they're talking about Raven King, and they keep talking about how he's, you know, his name is Black and he's a Black man.
Yeah.
I thought there's at some point something's going to happen here. And I really, really enjoyed where that went.
Oh, good. You were definitely ahead of me. I did not see that coming at all the first time through. But it's.
Yeah. Well, all the talk of, you know, that he would be a king. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, he's not going to be a king in England, though. Right.
Right. Right. I think the gentleman tells him, you're going to be a king in a place that you've been, and he's only ever been in, in England and lost hope. So yeah, you nailed it. Yeah. And Stephen is really great. I think he gets a little bit of short shrift in the miniseries, but, definitely, especially, I won't tell you how it ends in the miniseries, but it does end a little bit differently than in the book. And, yeah, his ending in the book is perfect. And, the fact that he is just so disgusted with England and the English and the way that they've treated him and his people to the point where he says at one point that it's almost a relief to go to Lost Hope to get away from the smugness, I guess, and the superior English. And so the fact that then at the end he has all the power of English magic and could take his revenge, could do whatever he wants, and decides that he's going to stop the gentleman and, you know, just leave. So I thought that was a really powerful ending.
Yeah, in many ways he's the most noble character in the book.
Yeah,
because you know, he's of course ill used just in the history of his family and his people, and has that opportunity to just smash England if he wants to, and doesn't do it.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Her secondary characters are really well written. What do you think about the gentleman as a villain?
Oh, I loved him, and on the audiobook especially, the voice characterization was really good on all the characters.
Oh, nice.
And you know, the gentleman just always has that tinge of, I mean, it's not even a tinge, right? It's out and out. He's pretty evil. You know, he's always talking about killing someone, or, you know, well, I've been really disappointed by this, so I should kill someone. You know, doesn't matter who. Oh, look, there's a guy coming, let's kill that guy.
Right It's funny that Strange says, and it's even I think the pull quote for part two, that a gentleman, a magician could kill someone with magic, but a gentleman never could. And of course the character called the gentleman kills hundreds of people probably in the book by magic. Yes. So
yeah, when he's recounting everything that he did to try to find Stephen Black's true name,
right? Yep.
And Stephen is just horrified at the body count.
Right.
I thought it was interesting that, you know, he never did find out the true name, right?
Yeah, I guess. So if he had found out the name, I guess the spell at the end where Strange and Norrell gave power to the nameless slave, I guess that would not have worked.
Right. Yeah.
So. We haven't, so he's not front and center in the book, but the Raven King, is all throughout this book.
Everywhere in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. And even more so on reread, I didn't realize that, like he's mentioned in the very first chapter and he just constantly comes up, and it seems like, definitely a picture of, sort of a, you know, you always have the free will versus divine providence discussion in theology. And so like how many strings exactly is the Raven King pulling? Because, you know, with Vinculus becoming his book, was that something that he set up? And then Vinculus is the one that talks to Segundus and gets Segundus to start asking questions. And then Segundus finds Norrell, and then Norrell goes to England and tries to chase Vinculus out of England. And then with those spells that Norrell wrote, Vinculus takes those to Strange, and then Strange gets added to the mix. And then, so it's this whole dominoes falling Like, is this entirely set up by the Raven King? Is he working through all these scenarios? Now, how exactly is he? How powerful is he still?
Right. Yeah, because I think some, I can't remember who says it, you know, that basically Strange and Norrell were essentially tools of the Raven King to bring English magic back.
Yep. Yeah, Vincula says that they are the Raven King's spell.
Right. Yeah, that's the wording.
Yep.
Anything else you got written down that you want to talk about?
Let's see. We haven't even talked about we didn't talk about Vinculus, which I thought was a great character, especially because he was a fraud.
Right.
I only saw it on reread that he gives a prophecy to Lascelles. He says he's going to lose his. He says he's going to drown. He's going to go mad, and think he promises all these different things that, of course, never come true, because he is a fraud. He does have the mission from the Raven King that he fulfills, but he's not really a magician himself. We didn't talk about Lady Pole. What did you think about her?
I thought she was an interesting character, and she definitely moved the plot forward in a couple of places where she tried to kill Nora.
Right.
And you know, I felt just terrible for her because she was completely innocent. Because here she was, this sickly young lady who happened to die, and if she had been left dead, that would have been tragic. Mm-hmm. But it was almost more tragic,
right,
to have her brought back in the way that Norrell brought her back,
right,
and into such terrible conditions. And you know, it shows you that when you're dealing with people from Faerie, you need to make sure that you have fully read the terms and conditions before you click accept.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's another kind of interesting point between the miniseries. In the miniseries, the gentleman is all about making deals, and it's always the gotcha kind of deals, like deals with the devil in popular stories. And in the book, he's a lot more just completely unpredictable and sort of gleeful and mischievous, as well as being
mercurial.
Right. So I thought that was interesting. Kind of those two different takes. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I thought it was interesting how she did such a good job at keeping it a realistic setting. A common question that people asked her apparently was, you know, why didn't she have main character female magicians? So why wasn't Jonathan Strange a female magician? And she said, you know, she wanted to keep it as authentic as possible for the time period. She wanted to not necessarily do social critiques, I think, which would be a really easy thing to do, writing from modern time period.
Yes.
She wanted to keep the world really close to the real world, because that would make the difference between fairy and the real world a much stronger comparison. Mm-hmm. I thought she did an excellent job. I also have not, like we both said, have not read a lot from that time period. Haven't read any gothic novels, which I think the last third of the book apparently is in that style.
Yeah.
But I thought she did a really excellent job with not I guess putting modern thoughts into these characters from a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah, it kind of limits the ways in which she can make the female characters strong.
That's true.
At least by how we would measure strong today, right? Where I think Arabella is an interesting character, and I think Lady Pole is an interesting character, but it's not because they're, out there doing magic and dealing with men as equals. Mm-hmm.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I mean, you can see that the reason that Jonathan Strange becomes a magician is because of Arabella, because he recognizes she's better than I am. Mm-hmm. And I need to do something to deserve her, right?
Right.
Where I have to make a change, and he decides on a whim, I'm going to be a magician, which I think is fascinating.
Right.
The other interesting thing, kind of springboarding on what you said about how things are different in Faerie, is that, you know, Stephen Black, who's this character who in England, yes, he's free, but he's also a servant. Mm. Where in Faerie, the gentleman recognizes him as having kingly bearing. Mm-hmm. And it's there's almost a seduction of that, right? Where, he definitely has a plight in England, where he's this at least in his circle of people who know him, he's this very noble person. Everyone loves him. Everyone recognizes his, not superiority, but they recognize him as being a person of quality. Mm-hmm. But to the general people who don't know him, he's another black man. Mm-hmm. And they treat him that way, which is tragic. And then the gentleman comes along and says, "You're important. Mm-hmm. You know, you should be a king. Mm-hmm. You're a beautiful man. I recognize your qualities." And that there's a seduction to that.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, even with all that he got put through and knowing how evil the gentleman is, Stephen is still, he still apologizes when he kills right. him. He still, I think he says, "I know you didn't mean any harm," or something like that.
Right. I thought that was fascinating. I'm like, I think he did mean some harm though.
right.
Just not to Stephen personally.
Yeah. Maybe that's what he meant.
Yeah. And I always like talking about, you know, something where there's been several times where I've read a book, mm-hmm. and I'm like, yeah, you know, that one, it didn't quite hit for mm-hmm. me. But it's always great to talk about it with somebody who likes it more than yeah. I do. And it kind of ends up bringing it up in my estimation.
Okay. Well, see, I was half expecting you to hate it. So I'm glad you got some enjoyment out of it. And
yeah, I did.
And yeah, it's, I was just going to say, if you do ever have the free time, I do think it really improves on reread. Even she is just so clever with her foreshadowing. I can't even imagine how much work she got went through. She could not have written this very linearly. She must have been jumping back and forth a lot. Even things like close to the end when the gentleman casts a spell to bring me to my greatest enemy, or bring me to the one who can do me the most harm. And
right. And it takes in Vinculus.
Well, so that's what I thought the first time through, but Vinculus is, at first it seems like nothing happens. And then Vinculus slowly, you know, makes his way to where they are. But you would expect the spell to just put him right in his presence.
Right.
So perhaps the spell did work, and Stephen, who ends up killing right. him, is actually who meant him the most harm. And since he's already right there next to the gentleman,
yeah,
that's how the spell, or why the spell seemed to not work, because they were already together. Right. So even things like that
makes sense.
Seem like she's really, really cleverly setting these things up.
Hmm. Yeah, I do like something that rewards a reread. Hmm. Unfortunately, my reading docket is so full, I can't imagine when I'm going to be able to get back to it.
Yeah, no, I definitely understand that. I rarely reread books.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll use audio to mm-hmm. kind of to review something that I enjoyed. And in this one, I know that the audiobook is good enough that I think I would enjoy that.
Yeah, maybe I'll check that out in a few years.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like I can't remember how many. It's like 29 hours or something like that. It's
wow. A big one. So there's still questions that I have. I still don't understand everything. Maybe the most interesting one is, why does Norrell, who destroys so many different magicians and even Strange, he doesn't let him have his books and withholds so much knowledge. So why does he let Childermas become a practical magician? You know, he makes snide comments about him doing the tarot cards and that, right. but he gives him spells to use to run Vinculus out of town. So why the double standard, do you think?
I think it's kind of something to do with the fact that Childermas is a servant,
mm-hmm.
and so he sees him as a tool in a lot of ways. I don't think he would have ever seen Childermas as a rival, even if he had known a lot of spells.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That probably is it. And just that, the same thing, I guess, if Stephen or someone had started doing magic. Interesting.
Yeah, but it's also interesting that there's a turning point in the book when he takes on Jonathan Strange as a student.
Mm-hmm.
Because up to that point, he's been destroying other magicians, right? Mm-hmm. He wants to be the only one, the preeminent magician in England.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes Jonathan on. And he tells him, you must read this book. And Jonathan says to him, well, then you must give it to me. And there's that pivotal moment when he releases the book. And it's almost like he's surprised to be giving him the book.
Right, right.
And Jonathan Strange is surprised to be receiving it.
Right. And I think No, go ahead.
Not that that opens the floodgates, right? Because he still withholds a lot of information from him.
Right. That's true. And I think I really liked the interaction between the two. And to your point earlier, when at the end they reconcile, it's one of my favorite, another one of my favorite moments when they're using a, I think a spell of summoning, and Norrell says, well, I have here in my drawer the best one that I know. And he pulls it out, and it's Strange's that he's just made a few yes. tweaks to. And that was also one of my stand up and cheer moments, I guess, from the book.
Right. Yeah. That's the teacher recognizing the brilliance of the student, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That is emotionally powerful.
I like one of my favorite little, there's a lot of humor in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And the way the writing is done, right?
That's true.
And I like early in the book when he's talking with Childermas about making magic respectable. Mm-hmm. And Childermas asks him, well, do you want to make it, you know, as respectable as the church? And it says here, Mr. Norrell, who knew there were such things as jokes in the world, or people would not write about them in books, but who had never actually been introduced to a joke or shaken its hand, considered a while. I just think that is a brilliant metaphor there.
That is really good. Let me, let me read my, I also had to mark down one of my favorite jokes, or one of her dry humor. So it's Norrell, and he was talking about one of his relations. It so happened that there was a distant connection of Mr. Norrell on his mother's side, who had once made himself highly disagreeable to Mr. Norrell by writing him a letter. To prevent such a thing ever occurring again, Mr. Norrell had made this man a present of £800, which was what the man wanted. But I'm sorry to say that this failed to suppress Mr. Norrell's mother's relative, who was steeped in villainy, and he had written a second letter to Mr. Norrell, in which he'd heap thanks and praise upon his benefactor, etc. So, she's definitely got the really dry, tongue-in-cheek humor down. Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes Norrell such an interesting character, right? The fact that he wants to bring magic into society, but he doesn't really want to be in society himself, right? He doesn't want to travel. He doesn't want to be in anyone's company. And even when he goes to that that party, and that's where he meets Drawlight, who of course is pretending that he's known him for ages. You know, he finds himself in a corner reading a book, which I can totally identify with, actually. It's like when I go to Las Vegas or something, I'm like, oh, there's people around here. And that's yucky.
Yep. Yeah. And the fact that he apparently was closer to Strange when he was younger, and was just disappointed that he never was able to contact the Raven King, turned him into, right. at least partly turned him into this more of a recluse, is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah. So I think it's stunning that this was her debut novel. She'd written some short stories, which if you like this book, you can check out The Ladies of Grace Adieu and Other Stories. It's a short story collection, and like most, it some hits and some misses. But yeah, stunning, I think, for a debut novel. She said that she planned to write more, but that was 15 years ago by now. So I know she said some health problems. I'm guessing she won't come out with any more, which is kind of a shame, but maybe it's for the best to leave this as a standalone. If she did come up with a sequel, I think it would definitely, I think she said it would probably be more like a Childermas Vinculus, not necessarily those characters, but that strata of society. And okay. I also think it's kind of interesting to think about what would happen when the 100 years of darkness ends for Strange and Norrell, assuming that they're still alive, that they are prevented from aging, or time moves differently inside. So they would have come out, I think it would have been like 1915 or something like that, 1916. So right in the middle of World War One. So that would be interesting. What, probably not a book I actually want to see written, but it's fun to imagine.
Yeah. I guess we didn't even talk about the fact that there's some ambiguity in the ending, right? Where you don't really know what became of Strange and Norrell. You just know that they're friends and partners again, which is good.
Right. So were you disappointed that, Strange just leaves his wife at the end?
I was. I mean, you know, as a married man, I thought, well, can she not go with him, you know?
Right. Yeah, so that, I guess that's part of what I meant with, it's not he's not the traditional hero. It's definitely not what you would expect. And yeah, he's an interesting character, like all the others.
Yep. Yeah, this is an interesting one. It's one that I'll definitely have to think about and probably reread at some point.
Cool.
But it's you know, I'm still kind of in the I admire it more than I like it.
Sure.
Yep. But there's a lot that I like about it.
Cool. Well, good. Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of the miniseries. You'll have to let me know what you think of that when you finish it.
Yeah, I've just got a few episodes left.
Okay.
I'll watch that this weekend.
Cool.
So, well, Brian, how can people find you?
Yeah, if you want to listen to our podcast, you can go to tto.koser.us. And we're still releasing episodes. And yeah, that's probably going to be the best way to get a hold of us. You can leave comments or send it to our email address from there, tto@koser.us.
Cool. And your wife, Melissa, has signed up to do an episode in the future. So
yeah. Yeah. She's excited about that. And I'm looking forward to listening to that. Yeah.
Well, I'll make sure to get any of your contact details.
Okay.
And put them in the show notes.
Perfect.
Well, Brent, I really want to thank you for doing this. I love that you reached out to me on the contact form. It's I love the networking that I've been able to do with podcasts, and it's really cool. It was a pleasure having you.
It was absolutely my pleasure as well.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks.
Bye. Well, everybody, thank you so much for listening. And I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Brian. Definitely encourage you to check out his podcast. I'll put his links in the show notes. Now to the announcement that I promised you. I'm starting a new podcast with my son, and it's going to be posted on the Hugo's site, but as a different podcast. Unfortunately, when I registered my feed URL, I didn't register the Hugo specific feed. I registered the master podcast feed for hugospodcast.com. I've rectified that situation now. I've gone back to iTunes and Google and actually resubmitted my URL, my feed URL. So it's specific to the Hugo's podcast. So if you're a new listener, you probably don't have to do anything. But if you're somebody who's been with me for a long time, if you want to only get the Hugo show, you'll need to update your feed URL. I'll put the feed URL in the show notes. I'll also tweet it out on social media. Otherwise, what's going to end up happening is you're going to hear the new episodes for the new podcast in this feed. So if you're okay with that, if you like me and you're interested in what we're going to be doing, we're going to talk mostly about movies, so it'll be something different. But if you want to resubscribe, I will not be offended. And like I said, I'll provide that in the show notes and on social media. So sorry for the trouble here, folks, but my son asked me to do a podcast with him and I couldn't say no. And I didn't want to spend extra money registering another site. And my podcast plugin on WordPress allows me to do more than one. So it was just poor planning on my part. But if you want to resubscribe, go for it. Okay. Of course, if you want to reach out to me, you can do that. Brian reached out to me using the contact form. If you want to volunteer to guest, fill that thing out or send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com. Love to hear from you. Follow me on Twitter @hugospodcast. Like our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/hugospodcast. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Coming up on 2 years doing this, and I'm really enjoying it still. So I guess that'll do it for this time. Talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.